Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we visit with a couple of guests we've had many times and always have a lot of fun talking with. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston are back with us. Lisa, Dane County UW Extension horticulture educator and very involved in the Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Lisa, great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry.
Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. And Brian, good to see you again
good
as well.
Good to see you too, Larry.
And we can talk about fall cleanup. We can talk about how to get rid of plant diseases, how to prepare your garden for winter. And, of course, we'll take your calls. So please do join in. And it's easy to do. You can just call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can go ahead and post on our Facebook page. If you've got some cool garden photos, we always love to see those photos on our Facebook page, so please do that. Well, we've had some unusual fall weather this year on top of the unusual summer weather. Brian, from you, how's it affected the gardens?
Well, it's been a good year in the clinic, let me put it that way. So we had so much rain this year that that's always great for plant diseases. And so we've been seeing a lot of samples come in, and I've actually seen some diseases in the clinic that I've never seen before. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's a little unusual. I mean, occasionally we'll get things in that I've not encountered. But in 20 years, I've been my job almost 20 years now, so it's kind of unusual to see new stuff. So yeah. I've been having fun. That excites me to see new stuff. And I'm a little worried about the cold weather, though, the warm weather into the fall, and I'm just hoping we don't get a real precipitous drop in temperature, because that's always tough on plants.
Yeah. Lisa, from your perspective?
Well, yeah, that lot of diseases this year. We also had a lot of insect issues. Japanese beetle, my goodness, I got all kinds of calls about Japanese beetle and about jumping worms. But for the diseases, yeah, we got a lot of questions about tomato fungal issues and powdery mildew and...
Well, my tomatoes, I had no problems this year. I was
good for you.
One
You're
of those rare birds, I guess.
I'm sure some other folks would be happy to share inoculum with you, so you could share the joy of the tomato blights.
Well, you know what, Brian on Green Bay has a question for you. I think it's Brian. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just had a question. My girlfriend. About a month and a half, 2 months back, bought me a black ball, B-A-L-L, orchid. And we've been lightly watering it, but since we've had to close the windows, of course, and turn the heat on, I was wondering if that was going to affect it at all. From what I researched, it was only supposed to live for about 3 or 4 weeks, and like I said, we've had it for 2 months. I was just wondering if you had any tips on how to, you know, care for it.
All right, Lisa.
Sure. You're right that orchids do like humidity, and of course, once we turn on the heat, that really eliminates a lot of our humidity. What I usually tell people who have ferns that need humidity or orchids or something like that is to put them on a tray or a dish full of pebbles that you have filled up that dish with water, and that can help to humidify the immediate environment around the plant. You can try spritzing, you know, the misting. However, it doesn't tend to last very long. You can always run humidifiers as well. Any of those things can help.
Yeah.
One thing I'll comment, if you're going to put it on that tray of pebbles, mm-hmm. is make sure the bottom of the pot is not sitting in the water.
Right,
it should be
exactly.
elevated above, because orchids tend to have problems with root rots if the root system gets too wet.
Yeah, that's the reason for the pebbles.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so you do need to make sure about that.
Yeah, good luck with
excellent.
It.
Awesome, thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Again, email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Let's go back to diseases for just a minute, Brian. What's the best way, you know, we're talking about getting rid of garden waste right now, if you've got some diseased stuff out there.
Yeah, my recommendation, certainly with leaves from trees, rake those up. If you're in an urban area that has a city compost place, you can take that material there. Lots of times the cities will collect up the leaves. With herbaceous garden waste, once it's died back, once we get a frost, if we ever get a frost, yeah. then you can cut that back if you'd like. Some people like to leave it up for winter, kind of visual aspects in the wintertime. If you're going to do that, make sure you cut it off before the plants start to sprout next year. So a lot of the disease-causing organisms will survive in that old plant debris. And then that material can be, I usually tell folks, you can burn it if you want to. Not very environmentally friendly, isn't an option in urban settings, but in more rural settings, that might be a possibility. Mm-hmm. You can bury it if you want to with just a thin layer of soil over the material. Or if you like to compost, you need to hot compost. So make sure that the pile gets up to the appropriate temperature. Lisa, what's your recommendation?
135.
Yeah, I usually say around 140, so I'm glad I'm in the right ballpark. and then make sure it's turned regularly, because it's that combination of heat and decay in the compost pile that will eliminate disease-causing organisms, or at least a lot of them.
All right. Well, Bob in Eau Claire has a question. Let's go there, or a comment. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have found an organization that is a procrastinator's delight. the Xerxes Society.
Oh, sure.
And they are proponents of leaving the leaves lay, and not rake them up, and not cut down the remains of your garden for the winter. And the primary reason for doing that is that you've got a lot of pollinators that will be hibernating over winter in your yard, especially if your yard has been an attractive stop for those pollinators. I think that's excellent. It makes a lot of sense to me, and I just I'm curious how you guys react to that.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling, Lisa. Comment from you.
Sure, you're right. A lot of those stalks, particularly plants that have hollow stalks, you can have pollinators hibernate in that area. I would say that if you are going to go that way, just like Brian said, you do need to remove the material before it starts to grow again in the spring. And whether or not that works with the pollinator's life cycle, I don't know for sure, because I don't know when a lot of those things hatch. I think there's definitely, good research evidence about that. Myself, I work two jobs in the spring, so I don't have time. So I have to clean up my landscape in the fall, and I hope I'm not eliminating the overwintering spots for a lot of pollinators. What you could do if you wanted to is maybe leave up some of the native species that might be particularly attractive to pollinators, and then again, just get rid of the material in spring.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, and the removing the material really is predicated on the idea that it's diseased when we go over the summer as we go into the fall, and so you're removing it to get rid of the disease-causing organism. If your plants are perfectly healthy going into the fall, then that's not as critical because, again, it's not going to harbor the pathogen.
Right. And some things like grasses, you pretty much have to cut them down before they start to grow again.
Yeah, so there we go. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate the call. Tony in New Holstein, it's your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey, so my wife received a rose bush, white roses, from her grandma after she had passed away this last spring. So she planted them, and it took root, and we had good flowers here up until about 2 weeks ago. I was just wondering what the proper steps were to winterize this rose bush, how far back to cut it, and we were told to pile finished compost in the middle of the plant afterwards to create a frost barrier. It's better than using those styrofoam buckets you see. And I was wondering what the right steps were.
Do you know what type of rose this is? Is it a grafted rose? Is it a shrub rose?
No, I'd be lying if I said that I knew the difference.
Okay.
They're just big, big white roses on what looks to be more of a, it's more stemmy than bushy, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Sorry, it's not a real scientific term there. Yeah.
Okay. The reason that I asked is the hybrid teas and the floribundas and the grandifloras that are grafted, usually there's a big knob at the base of the stems where it's grafted onto the rootstock. And those do need protection over the winter. So, yes, piling something around the crown of the plant. Usually I recommend whatever is easiest to remove in spring. It might be bark. You don't want something that's going to collect a lot of water over the winter, so I do like to use bark or leaves or something like that that drains well, as opposed to soil. But basically what you do need to do for those plants is cover the base. Now, if you have something like the knockout roses that die back during the winter anyway and come back from the roots, then you don't need to do that procedure. If you have a shrub rose, most of those like rugosa roses and so on don't need to have that. So if you don't see a big knob at the base, probably you are dealing with something that is not grafted.
Look for the big knob and bury it.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. If you find that. If you're not sure and you want to hedge your bets, yes, going ahead and covering it regardless of whether it's grafted or not, or if you're not sure, you can't tell, that's a good way to go. And then next spring, maybe send a photo into your extension office.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly once it blooms, so that they can tell you whether they think it's a shrub rose or something that's grafted.
And if you are going to put something on, do you do it now or do you wait till the ground's frozen?
You want to wait until the ground's frozen. Yeah.
Okay.
Which not as much fun, but
and then you want to take that off in the spring,
right?
As well.
Yeah. You want to take it off about the time that you start to see the buds swelling. Is a good time to do it. You don't want to wait until it leafs out.
All right. Well, thank you for the info, guys.
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Zach in Milwaukee has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Zach.
Hey, guys. I have some heritage raspberries, and so they grow their canes through the year and then fruit at the end. But not all of the canes fruit, and so I was wondering if I left the ones that didn't fruit this year, would they fruit like in the early summer or spring, or are they just kind of lost causes?
No, they should fruit for you. I was trying to remember. I think heritage is what they call a fall-bearing raspberry. So typically, they should all fruit, but you might have a young one that got started later in the year, and so it didn't fruit. But yeah, if it has not fruited, you can definitely leave it till next year. Now, the ones that have fruited, some people like to take them out entirely, and if you've had any disease, that's definitely recommended. If you want, though, often the fall-bearing ones will have a lighter spring crop if you cut them back a little bit. This is not the case, though, with summer-bearing ones. Summer-bearing ones, they're done after they've fruited. So, mm-hmm. So there is that kind of dichotomy. But yeah, if it hasn't fruited this year, I would imagine it's going to do it next year.
Brian, did you see any diseases this year in raspberries?
Yeah, cane blight is a big one. It's a fungal disease, and that will girdle the canes and cause them to die back. So that's relatively common. In wetter soils, we tend to see root and crown rot problems as well, so that can take out entire plants. I'm trying to think if anything else. We see some leaf diseases this year because it was a little wetter.
Yeah.
And then I think the big thing to worry about, particularly with fall-bearing raspberries, would be spotted-winged Drosophila, quite frankly, which is an insect pest.
Right.
Yeah.
I had anthracnose on my canes the other year.
Yes, that will certainly come in. That makes nice discreet spots.
Yeah, I was pleased. I knew what it was.
Yes, it actually looks like the pictures. The cane blight is a little bit more amorphous. It just kind of discolors the canes and then girdles them and causes them to die back.
So there you go, Zach. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston are our guests today for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at everything in the garden today and probably a little in the lawn and with your trees and shrubs as well with our two guests. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW. Questions? All of our lines are filled. The number is 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Ron in New Lisbon has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ron.
Good morning. I planted 8 fruit trees in the spring of 2014. They were 4 to 6 feet tall. And I planted them basically in what I call beach sand, but I did dig out an area 3 foot in diameter and 3 foot deep and manure in compost and then good topsoil in that area. And then I've tried to keep fertilizing, putting compost farther out to hopefully help build the soil up as they grow roots. But there are 2 peach, 2 pear, 3 apple, and a plum. And I was wondering, I got basically 3 questions. Would it be okay to prune them now, fertilize them now, and if it is okay to, or whenever it's okay to fertilize them, what would be the best analysis of fertilizer to use?
Okay, we've got 3 or 4 different fruits here,
yeah.
Trees.
But none of them should be pruned now. You want to do your pruning during the dormant season, so they have to be really well dormant. Usually we tell people not to do it until after January or late January for the pruning. You also don't want to fertilize now. Typically that is done in the spring. And there's actually kind of a formula that is used where you match up the amount of nitrogen that's in the product with the caliper of the tree, which is the diameter of the tree. What you might want to do is take a look at our publications at the Learning Store. We have growing apples in Wisconsin, we have growing pears in Wisconsin, and we have growing, what is it, plums?
Plums, peaches and cherries.
Cherries, that's the one.
In Wisconsin.
Yeah, so.
Maybe not in that order, but.
Yeah. But those 3. So I would recommend that. It's learningstore.uwex.edu is the website. And if you don't have access, internet access, you can get those publications through your county extension office. But they tell you everything you need to know about the pruning, the fertilization.
Disease get in there too, Brian?
There's a little bit of disease information on there, although I think if you want more detail, our fact sheets for some of the diseases are a little bit more, a little better for that.
Mm-hmm. So the good old 10-10-10 isn't necessarily the best thing to fertilize all those trees with.
Not necessarily, no.
And the other thing, given that you're on sand, you might want to invest in some soil testing just to see where you are in terms of nutrients, not only kind of the macronutrients like the NPK, but also some of the micronutrients.
Yeah.
Because you might run into issues with those as well.
But at this stage, most of the roots are in what I put in there. I mean the manure, the compost, and the true topsoil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, so, but that is going to
so testing,
degrade.
You know, out in the middle of the lawn really isn't going to tell me anything in that sense.
No, you'd want to do it near the root system of the trees. The
yeah, and I
trees.
Don't think I probably got my mixture the same for all the trees, so that might be an interesting...
Yeah,
be interesting to see. And you could do that now.
Yeah, you can definitely.
Well, yeah, the soil test.
Yeah, in fact, it's
good time to do it.
It's a good time to do it when the soils lab isn't inundated with samples.
And what I have done on this is I actually wrap the trunks because they're not that big in the fall, and then I actually put compost up around the trunk quite a ways up, and then first thing in the spring as things are starting to green up, I remove that away from the base of the tree, so there's actually an indentation, because I can't overwater these trees. I literally, when I planted them, I watered one tree for 5 days, didn't realize I had the hose on. Two hours later, you couldn't tell which tree I'd watered for 5 days. Oh, so that is the one nice thing about the sand, I mean, is you can't overwater.
Yeah, right, exactly. But
I would be a little cautious about the wrap that you're using on the trunks. If you want to do that as a protectant for over the winter, I think you'll probably be fine, but I would definitely take that off in the spring.
Right, and I would not pile compost up against the trunk either. A lot of respiration goes on with the trunk tissue, and putting compost up against it is really not recommended.
And I
put the wrap on first, then I only go up what would probably be an inch or two above what is the ground level. So it's not like I'm piling it up high. I'm more concerned about I'm not getting winter kill because, especially the peach trees.
Right.
Some of these severe winters. My sister, she had some of these trees, and they all died off on her.
Yeah, that's pretty typical for peach.
Yeah, they're not very hardy in our area, unfortunately. The joke has always been that the fruit specialist will never have to write a publication on pruning mature peach trees because they
they never reach maturity.
Yeah, the longest lived one that I know of was 14 years, which is, you know,
that's
really
not bad.
Pretty
long.
Good. A lot of them only last like 5 years. Yeah. You know, less than 10. So I would steel yourself.
Yeah. And now you know what's going to happen, Lisa. You're going to get 10 phone calls from people that say,
yes,
I have
right.
a 30-year-old peach. There you go. Thanks, Ron. Appreciate the call. Kirk in Beloit, it's your turn. Hi, Kirk.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have several large white pine trees. And I think last summer, a pileated woodpecker got to one of them and opened up several large gashes. Is there anything I can do to either help the tree or kill the bugs, or what can I do to help it?
Boy, was the tree looking like it was in good health to start with?
Yep.
It was.
Yep.
Okay, because usually the woodpeckers, unless they're doing drumming for mating purposes in the spring, are not going to attack a healthy tree. But now that you've got that, unfortunately, there isn't a whole lot that you can do about that. Pine trees will produce a lot of pitch and try and block off any sorts of injuries like that. So unfortunately, there just isn't a whole lot that you can do.
Oh, yeah. Leave them alone.
Yeah.
Basic good watering, I suppose.
Yeah.
If it got dry, you just want to kind of optimize the tree's ability to form tissue to close over that wound.
Yeah.
Is there anything I can put on the wound to keep out diseases? Will it get some kind of disease?
No, we usually don't recommend any sort of like pruning paints or those sorts of things. It's very rare that we recommend those anymore because they oftentimes interfere with that normal tissue development that will close over the wound. So the main thing is, again, just to make sure that the tree's watered optimally. Again, for an established tree, about an inch of water per week, either from rain or supplemental watering, and then just allow the tree to kind of recover on its own.
Yeah. As long as we're on white pines, Dennis and Marinette emailed to ask when he should prune his white pines.
Again, I would recommend that as a kind of a winter pruning sort of thing in
well,
general.
Well, generally we don't prune pines because they only grow from the tips. Now, if you're trying to like prune for clearance or something like that, like you said, winter would be a good time to do that. But in general, we don't recommend any kind of tip pruning because that will take away the growing point, and then you have a problem.
There we go. And Kirk, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Deb in Stockton, Minnesota, a chance to join us. Let's go there. Deb, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a weeping fig that's about 6 feet tall and about 4 feet in diameter, and it has mealybugs. And, you know, I've read that you can use, you know, wash it off with a strong spray of water or insecticidal soap. But how would I get to all the little crevices and things where the mealybugs are on such a big plant?
Yeah, it is a bit of a challenge when you have something that's that large. When I have treated figs that are large like that, what I've done is I've put down a sheet of plastic, first of all, and you know, sometimes I've had to use a chair or a ladder. What you can use, and I would definitely check the label, because sometimes figs can be a little sensitive to different formulations of products, and some things that will kill mealybugs, like you said, insecticidal soap. You want to try and concentrate on underneath the leaves, in the axils, which are the where the leaf meets the stem, and also in the crotches, are where mealybugs tend to like to be. Yeah, there are different products. We do, I think we have a fact sheet.
We have a fact sheet on mealybugs. If you go to my clinic website, if you're hooked up to the internet, it's pddc.wisc.edu. There's a fact sheet section. Just select all in the main, in that drop-down menu that you get when you hover over or click on the fact sheets, and then you get an alphabetical listing, and just look for mealybugs. There's information there.
Okay.
PDDC, right?
Yes.
Yeah, for plant disease diagnostics.
Could you do that again?
Yeah, it's PDDC.
PDDC.
Yep, .WISC, short for Wisconsin.
Okay.
.EDU, short for education.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Robin in Portage has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Robin.
Good morning, Larry and Gus.
Good morning.
My question is kind of a 3-4-part question about my black raspberries.
Okay.
My number one question would be, when do you cut them back and how far?
I'm trying to remember with the black raspberries whether those are on a 2-year cycle or a 1-year cycle. I am not going to guess on that.
Okay.
If they're on, I can tell you what to do depending on how they actually produce. If they are on a 2-year cycle where they produce in summer, then typically what you're going to want to do is prune them back during the dormant season. And what a plant that is, or a raspberry plant that is a summer bloomer or a summer bearer as opposed to a fall bearer, those are going to need to be, you remove the entire cane, but you leave the ones that did not produce. So again, being on a 2-year cycle. Now, if they are fall bearing types, then they produce a new cane every year that will fruit, but it's later in the season. So do you get those in midsummer?
Mine are in the summer.
Okay. Yeah. I would suggest taking a look at our publication, Growing Raspberries in Wisconsin, because I want to make sure that I'm giving you the correct information on black raspberries. So there is a section in there on when to prune those.
And that's at the Learning Store.
That's at the Learning Store.
So learningstore.uwex.edu.
Right.
Okay.
And just search on raspberry, and then it's Growing Raspberries in Wisconsin. Those are great publications.
Yeah.
All right. And the rest of my question is, I did have rust this year, but it did not go through the whole patch. I never got to cutting them out before. By the time I noticed it, it was too late. I couldn't get to them. So how is that going to affect the rest of them? I mean, they did not all get it by any means, which I was surprised.
Unfortunately, in order to tell you exactly what to do, I'd have to see a sample of that, because there are several different rust diseases that occur on raspberries, some of them much more serious than others. Now, the plants that had the disease, were they stunted and kind of yellowish?
No, they just had the orange rust.
Orange, okay, so it's not, I think orange rust is the one that actually has become systemic and causes a lot of stunting. If you ever see that, just dig out the plants and get rid of them. For some of the other rusts, again, it depends on the rust because some have alternate host. One of them has an alternate host, which I believe is, as I recall, is white spruce. And so the spores that infect your raspberries are actually coming off the spruce trees. Then there's another one that I believe is just completes its entire life cycle on the raspberry plants. But again, I'd have to see a sample of that in my clinic to tell which one you're dealing with. So if you see that again next year and want to get a formal diagnosis so we can get you some specific recommendations, again, if you go to my website, there's information on how to submit a sample and just send me some of the leaves and we'll take a look at the spores. We can identify which one it is and then tell you what to do.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling.
Yeah, I wish I could do an easy answer on that one, but there are a ton of different rusts on raspberries.
Rick in Monona has a question for us. Hi, Rick.
Hi, I'm enjoying your show as usual.
Thank you.
I'm wondering about a thing. We have raised beds in our backyard, and we love to plant tomatoes. And every year we get what I think is tomato blight. It starts at the bottom and goes up the plant and kills limbs and leaves as it goes up, and they all turn black.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to get rid of that? Is there anything I can do in the wintertime to stop that?
Yeah, our general recommendation is to start at this time of the year for management. And you're probably dealing with one of two diseases, or perhaps both of them. There's one called early blight, one called septorial leaf spot. They both do exactly what you're talking about. They start on the bottom of the plant and work their way up. These are fungal diseases. Good cleanup this fall to remove as much of that old tomato debris as you possibly can. If you happen to grow potatoes as well, I would remove all of that debris because the early blight fungus will also infect potatoes. And then as you're thinking about what you're going to plant in terms of tomatoes next year, you could think about possibly growing a resistant variety, although sometimes the flavor of the fruit of those resistant varieties is not real flavorful, so you have to be aware of that, but that certainly is an option. And then when you go to plant the plants next year, I would move them to another area of your garden. The sort of idea of rotating vegetables from place to place in your plot is always good. It's not a great strategy for specifically dealing with these foliar blights like you're dealing with, but it's always a good practice to do. And then when you put the plants in the best of all possible worlds in terms of spacing, when those plants are full size, the foliage on adjacent plants should not overlap. What you want to do is have a lot of airflow in the canopy of that plant, so if the leaves get wet, they dry really, really rapidly. And then in addition to that, as the plants get larger, you want to prune off some of the lower leaves. If you have a lot of suckers, you want to prune those out. Again, so you get good air penetration and rapid drying. Once you get the plants in, mulch underneath the plants, just about maybe just an inch of mulch. And then I would also, quite frankly, go over and mulch where you had tomatoes last year or potatoes, because what you're trying to avoid is, even though you're really diligent about removing all that old plant debris, you're going to leave some of it. You just can't get it all. And that's where these fungi survive, and they'll start to generate spores. And you want to basically block those from getting out of the soil and into the air where they can move over to your new plants. And then when you're watering, don't use a sprinkler. Really bad news. And I know Mother Nature sprinkle irrigates, but if we usually have to add water ourselves, and when you do that, use a soaker or a drip hose, get that moisture in the soil and keep it off of the leaves. And then if you're absolutely desperate, there are some fungicide treatments, but quite frankly, I usually tell home gardeners, if you're to the point where you have to use a fungicide to get tomatoes, go to the local farmer's market and buy some.
Yeah.
It'll be cheaper and probably healthier for you to do that. And those are all some things that you can do. We do have two fact sheets, one on early blight, one on septorial leaf spot. If you go to my clinic website into the fact sheet section, you can take a look at that and read up more on the diseases. But that's kind of the general strategy that I usually tell folks.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thanks so much for calling. That's one of the things, and I've mentioned this before, but it's one of the things about straw bales, that planting your tomatoes in straw bales is... For me, it's where I have not had a disease problem for 3-4 years now, because I use straw bales, and I had more tomatoes than I could even use this year. So it was it's been a good strategy for me every year to put my tomatoes in straw bales. Rick, thank you again. Ellen in Albany, it's your turn. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have been growing dahlias for a number of years, and I always dig up the tubers at the end of the fall, discard the foliage, winter over the tubers, and then, you know, plant them again the next year. And I noticed this year more disease, or for the first time maybe, disease in some of my dahlia plants. I think it maybe was like a mildew. They kind of died from the bottom up, and they still continued to flower, and they have been right up till this point. But a lot of the leaves are brown and dead from the bottom, creeping up to the top. And I'm just wondering if I would be better off to just get rid of those tubers and start over with fresh plants. It didn't affect all my plants. But it did affect maybe certain varieties, I think, of the dahlias.
Yeah, my suggestion would be not to give up on those particular tubers, because from what you're describing, it sounds like some sort of leaf disease rather than something that's going into the tubers and causing rot problems. That's probably the most serious sort of disease I see on dahlias, where you'll get a rot organism to just kind of take out the tuber. It sounds like something that's infecting the leaves. Those are usually out in the environment somewhere. And the reason why you may be seeing differences in the varieties may be simply because they have different levels of resistance to whatever disease you're dealing with. It could be a powdery mildew. It's hard to tell based on your description. It could be some other sort of fungal disease. But I don't think I would discard those. I would sort them out, take a look to see if you see any of the tubers that look, you know, rotten or discolored, get rid of those, and then go ahead and replant those other plants. I don't see any compelling reason not to save those at this point.
Yeah.
But definitely, if you continue to see problems, again, if you go to my website, there's contact information there for me. Give me a call, email me or call me, and we can talk some more if you see problems next year.
All right,
thanks.
Welcome.
And along with dahlias, Paula on Facebook says she dug out her dahlias yesterday and left them in the sun to dry. Would they have frozen if it went below 32 degrees last night?
Hmm. Well, it depends on how far below. It's usually recommended that they not be left out if it goes below, like, 40. It's really hard to tell. If they feel mushy, that might be an issue. Then you might have toasted those. But I would still go ahead and bring them in and check them, you know, in a couple of weeks and see if you see any damage to the tubers.
Yeah, that makes good sense. It reminds me again that I have to bring Limey in. From Limey, my lime tree, our lime tree has been outside is currently outside, but I think sometime late afternoon today, Limey will be coming inside and spending winter inside.
Good plan.
Talking all things in the garden with Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston. Lisa, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, very involved in the Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW. One open line at 800-642-1234. Mike in Algoma emailed, and you can email us, by the way, at ideas@wpr.org. Mike emailed that he has a cherry tree that he wants to move to a new location since it blooms so early. He wants to move it now. Do you have a recommendation on moving it now instead of next spring?
Well, I'm wondering if it's an ornamental cherry. Maybe it's the pie-type cherry? It's hard to...
We can't tell.
I can't tell from that. Generally, for moving fruit trees, though, we would recommend spring. Moving it at this time of year, chances are it's not going to get roots established and you could have some damage. So I'd still recommend spring when it's dormant, if at all possible. So maybe March or very early April would be the time to do it.
Let's go to Jeff in La Crosse. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, good morning. I have a couple of questions. Wonder if you could... expand on tomato blight. I'm curious to know if it goes into the tomato at towards the end of the year, because a lot of my later tomatoes started developing just brown, almost like bruised spots around them. And the other question I had was my Brussels sprouts. I've had real good Brussels sprouts in the past. I got them in raised bed. Last year, the plants got huge. I topped them in September, and I didn't get a single Brussels sprout. This year, I planted them by seed in early June. My plants are small now, and I topped a couple of them, and it doesn't seem to be helping. They're about pea size right now. Okay. And then I pulled a couple of them for experimental purposes, and I pulled some of the lower leaves off, hoping that they would get bigger. Hmm. But I'm just...
at a little bit of a loss. Well, let's go with the tomatoes first. Brian, I bet you've got an idea about that.
Yeah, the two diseases that I talked about earlier typically do not affect the actual tomato fruit. So you oftentimes get a what I call the Charlie Brown Christmas tree sort of tomato where, you know, no leaves at all, but the little ornaments, which are the fruits that hang on the plant. Now, if you're seeing lesions on the or infected areas on the fruits, are those kind of brown and leathery looking, or they look kind of sunken and very circular?
They start out, yeah, they get sunken and circular. They start out small and just gradually get bigger.
Yeah, my guess is if you saw big leathery sorts of infected areas on the fruits, then I would worry about late blight, which is the other major blight disease that we have. And those, if you see that sort of symptom, those plants, it'll usually go to the foliage as well. Those plants should be dug up and double bagged and then sit them out in the sun and let them cook. That's the way you get rid of that particular pathogen. And you definitely want to remove all of the material and make sure it's destroyed. You don't want that one surviving the winter locally. And if you're seeing those kind of sunken areas, my guess would be a disease called anthracnose, although I'd have to see some of the fruits to tell you for certain. That's kind of a really disappointing disease because oftentimes the fruits look perfectly fine on the plant, and then you pick them and bring them in and sit them on your counter to ripen a little bit, and that disease will get started. Unfortunately, you know, part of what you're dealing with most likely is that we had a really wet growing season, and the anthracnose fungus is around in the environment, and there's not a lot you can do to avoid that under these really wet conditions. But again, I would make sure you just do good fall cleanup, do the sort of rotation thing, move your plants to a new location in your garden the way I talked about for the blights, and that in part should take care of the problem. But again, with a wet year like we had this year, you can do all of these things and it doesn't make any difference.
Would blossom end rot be an idea for that or not?
If they're very localized and they're kind of on the sides of the fruits, it's unlikely that it's blossom end rot. End rot will be on the bottom of the fruit most typically. And again, that's not actually a disease. That's a fertility issue, and it's a calcium deficiency in the plants. But I wouldn't expect there to have been a real serious problem with that because of the amount of moisture we have. Oftentimes that's associated with drought conditions. But certain varieties, like the Roma-style tomatoes, tend to have more of a problem with that than some of the other varieties.
All right.
In terms of the Brussels sprouts, I'm wondering whether, could that be a fertility issue, do you think?
Yeah, maybe it's a fertility issue. Do you fertilize a lot with nitrogen?
Well, it's been pretty much a straight compost from the city compost pile.
Okay. So you bought starter plants or you started them inside yourself and then this year you seeded, is that correct?
I planted some early in the year with starter plants and they tend to get eaten up by the cabbage worms.
Right, right.
And so I started planting them later.
Okay.
By seed, you know, in early June.
Yeah. Well, typically those take like 6 to 8 weeks to get to the point that you could put them outside. So that's why people usually start them inside or buy starter plants. So I guess with the seed started, I'm not really surprised that they are still a little bit small. Have you grown them before and had success?
Oh, yeah, I've done that numerous times before. But like I said, last year was all plants and no Brussels sprouts. And this year, like you said, probably just a late start.
Mm-hmm.
And they look great right now, but there's no Brussels sprouts.
Yeah. Oh. Ah, that's sad.
Yeah.
Not really sure what is causing that.
Well, there's always next year.
Yeah.
With the big plants and no Brussels sprouts, would that be nitrogen, too much nitrogen?
Well, that was why I was wondering about fertility, because you mentioned very large plants, but none of the sprouts.
But the sprouts
before.
are leafy materials,
though,
which,
too.
So that really shouldn't affect it. But, not sure what the story is there.
You're just going to have to try again next year, Jeff, and see what happens.
Are you planting them in the same space every year?
Yeah, it's raised beds, and I kind of rotate them around.
Okay.
That's good.
All right, that's good then.
Well, there's always next year.
Yeah. Don't give up.
I'm sorry we couldn't help you with that one anymore, Jeff. Let's go to Mike in Madison, see what's on Mike's mind. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I have had a huge problem with powdery mildew decimating my cucumbers and pole beans this year. But just outside my garden, I have a 20-year-old peony plant, which was just about destroyed from the white powdery mildew. So my two questions are, is this going to affect, did it come from my garden, and is it going to affect other vegetables in my garden? And will this affect the peony next year, much like a tomato blight? Will it stay with the plant?
Yeah, the thing about powdery mildews is it's not a single organism that's causing the problem. There are lots of different powdery mildew fungi that are out there, and the one that you're seeing on your peony is unlikely to be the same one you're seeing on your cucumbers and other vine crops. So you're likely going to see those every year. We tend to see those when we have high humidity. So oftentimes they'll show up about midsummer in a typical summer where, we get rain in the spring and then it kind of dries off and gets really muggy later on. And it can be really devastating on cucurbits. So cucumbers, pumpkins, those sorts of things. So my recommendation for those sorts of crops would be to look around in your seed catalog, or when you buy transplants, look for ones that are rated as resistant to the disease. That won't guarantee that you don't get any powdery mildew, but you'll get less powdery mildew than on a susceptible variety. And sometimes that can certainly help things out. And the other thing with cucumbers, I oftentimes recommend trellising, so you can kind of train the vines to be far apart. You get better airflow in between the leaves, and that'll kind of reduce the humidity to the point where the powdery mildews don't do quite as well. In terms of your peony, are you seeing them totally die back, or the leaves are still there, but they're just covered with white?
It's covered with the white, and it just about killed the plant. I mean, it wilted. This is a few weeks ago and during the real hot weather, but it just about died.
I wouldn't expect the powdery mildew on that host to cause wilting and dieback like that. It's usually a very cosmetic problem. They'll get really white, but that particular disease typically does not kill plants. And on most types of plants, powdery mildews are relatively cosmetic. If you're seeing dieback in your peony, then my concern would be, again, because we had such a wet season, you may have a crown rot issue in the plant, and that may be the underlying really serious problem that you're dealing with. What I would suggest, if you let them sprout again, and if the plants come back and they look kind of stunted and discolored, then that's a good indication that you're probably dealing with a crown rot. And then you could give me a call and we can talk about options for management. We probably have to see a sample in the clinic, because there are lots of root rot pathogens that potentially can cause problems. And particularly if you want to use some sort of chemical control, you need to know which organisms you're dealing with, because the control products are very different depending upon the pathogen. But with the powdery mildew, if you're really desperate, if you don't like the look of it, what we would normally recommend, if you want to try to spray something, well, one, you might try dividing the plants. If they're really large plants, that way you get better airflow again and tend to reduce the humidity. That can be one thing. That'll also allow you to get a look at the root system to see if there's any discoloration or rotted tissue as you do that. And then if you still continue to have problems, there are spray treatments. We do have some nice fact sheets on powdery mildews on my website that outlines kind of a home remedy that's based on some research out of Cornell, which is a combination of baking soda and horticultural, lightweight horticultural oil and water that you use as a preventative treatment. But again, on peony, I usually consider the disease cosmetic, so I tell folks to kind of get used to it and ignore it if you possibly can.
But do,
great, thank you.
Do good fall cleanup.
Yeah, do good fall cleanup. Although with perennials, the pathogen will survive in the crowns, in the overwintering buds as well. So it's great to take care of that debris, but it won't totally take care of the problem.
Is it safe to compost it?
Yes. If you do real hot composting, where you high temperature and turn it regularly to allow the material to decay rapidly, that should take care of powdery mildews.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Can we still plant bulbs? That's a question. I know that's come up a couple of times.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. It's better planting them a little bit later in the year as opposed to earlier. So even up in Green Bay, I would think that there's still plenty of time to do that. I wouldn't wait until the end of November up in that area, but... Yeah, you can still definitely do it now. I actually just gave a talk at Greene County last night about spring bulbs. So fresh in the mind.
it is fresh in your mind. Well, I tell you what. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston are our guests today. Lisa is the Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, very involved in the Master Gardener Volunteer Program. And, of course, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, our guests. And it's always fun and always a good time to have them with us for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. It's Garden Talk time, of course. I'm Larry Mueller. My guests, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, back with us once again. Lisa, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW within the Department of Plant Pathology. Lots of callers online, so I think we're just going to go right back to the phones and to Sharon in Partyville. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I have two questions.
Okay.
Okay, now my first one is going to be kind of silly, but when should we have cut back our lilac bush?
Well, actually, lilacs are best pruned in the spring after they flower. That way you won't eliminate any buds for next year's production. Now, so usually the spring flowering shrubs like mock orange and lilac and Vigala and those sorts of things, you want to prune them in the spring after they flower. However, if it's really overgrown and you want to do a major restructuring of it, you can do it during the dormant season. Just realize that you'll be pruning off a lot of the buds that would flower in the spring.
Okay.
And you take those right to the base, don't you?
Yeah, as much as possible.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, what they recommend for if it's really overgrown is a process called renewal pruning or thinning, and you take a third of the biggest, oldest stems right down to the base, and then you do your shaping, and that will help to keep it in vigorous growth. Is this a really old plant or a newer plant?
It's a newer plant.
It's a newer plant. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, usually we recommend every 3 years or so to do that sort of thing. So you don't necessarily need to do it every year.
Okay. All right. And now my other question is, I wanted to have monarch butterflies in the garden, and so what I planted was some milkweed.
Mm-hmm.
And what I got was milkweed with a lot of bugs that looked like box elder bugs.
Oh, yeah. That's the milkweed seed bug.
It is.
Yeah.
That's normal.
Yep. It's it is normal. I have seen more of them in the past couple of years than I had seen before, but they do feed on the seed pods. Usually they don't cause, you know, a ton of damage, so I wouldn't worry about spraying them or anything like that.
Okay. All right. Good.
But you're right. They do look very, they are related, so they do look very similar.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Probably seeing more of those bugs because a lot more people are planting
growing milkweeds.
milkweeds to attract monarchs.
Woohoo! So, more food.
More food there. Lois and Webster, your turn. Hi, Lois.
Yes. I turned your program on later, so I probably missed some tomato questions, but I do have a tomato question.
Okay.
Our tomatoes were beautiful this year, no blight, made beautiful green fruit. And then they start ripened, and just before they're totally ripened, we notice at the stem end this little dark place. It acts like it's trying to reach in and rot it or something. If I trim it off when I am using the tomatoes, you know, this flavor is still good. But what's causing that to happen at the stem end of the tomato?
So is it a little pinhole type?
No, it ends up actually about the size of a nickel when it's through.
Yeah, there are several things that could potentially be causing that. It's probably a fungal disease of some kind. Unfortunately, a recommendation for fruits like that is to discard them. We don't recommend cutting off that area and then using the rest of the fruit because that infection area can be an entry point for other more serious, not necessarily plant disease-causing organisms, but it could be something that might have a negative impact on human health. So okay. Our normal recommendation is if you have a blemished fruit like that is to discard the fruit and don't use it.
Yeah.
Well, what causes it?
It's probably, my guess would be a fungal of some kind, some sort of fungus. But without actually seeing the symptoms, it's hard to tell you exactly which one. And again, we had a very, very wet season this year. And that was really, the fungi loved this year. Yeah. So there were a lot of fungal diseases out there. So it doesn't surprise me that you had some issues.
Okay.
But if it's on the top, that kind of top on the shoulder, sometimes that can also be, depending upon how much foliage you have, you can also get sunburn symptoms as well.
I don't believe it's sunburn.
Okay. That's usually more of a bleached sort of look to the tissue.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. And Alice in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Alice.
Hi. Yes, I'm helping my neighbor plant some bulbs. And the end of September, I found some dahlias. I put them in the ground, in the garage, and in the sunny window. And they're coming up a couple of inches. But then I also found a couple of weeks ago some double begonias and hostas. And I'm wondering, am I going to be able to save any of these bulbs, or what's the best thing I can do?
Well, typically for dahlias, what we would recommend is that you let them go dormant. It sounds like yours have just started sprouting, though. Is that correct? Am I understanding that right?
Yes.
Okay. That's not ideal.
That's not good.
Not ideal. At this point, I am not sure how you're going to be able to overwinter that, whether it's better to, it's just a couple of inches up, you say?
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe bring it in? And
yeah, I would bring it in. Well, certainly you'd need to bring it in order to save it at all. If it hasn't got, you know, a lot of leaves on it, you might still be able to withhold water and let it go dormant. I'm just not sure how it's going to, because normally at this time of year, they would be going dormant and then you would store them. Typically, you know, you'd have cleaned off the soil and you would let it stay dry over the winter. Now, you should do the same thing for, are these, you're finding them as bulbs in the person's garage, is that what I'm understanding, or you're finding them in the ground?
They're in a bag. They purchased them and they were
Gotcha. Okay. So they just purchased them this year, or they've been sitting there for we don't
That's
know how long.
Question. Don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I would say it, with the begonias, if they are not withered up, if they still seem solid, usually what you want to do is store those in a dormant condition over the winter and, you know, keep them cool, keep them dry. And then usually around March, you would pot them up. Or if you want to put them into the ground, you would do that after frost. But if they seem like they're kind of withered and dry, then you probably would just discard them.
Okay. Right. And the hostas too, should I bother trying to plant them?
Yes, hostas are tough. I would not worry at all about putting them in the ground at this time of year. I've always said that they could probably overwinter in your driveway with their roots showing.
Okay.
That's a joke, by the way.
Yeah.
Do not try this at home. But yeah, you can go ahead and plant those.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jill in Racine has something for us. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I came outside to get a piece of the bayberry, and mine seems to be super miniature. I'm looking at the leaves. They're burgundy now, and there's some lower on the branch that are green, but when I get blossoms, they're bright yellow.
Okay.
Where would it grow best? Now I'm inside.
Okay.
So the entire plant looks kind of stunted.
Oh, miniature.
And you got kind of purpley foliage.
Yes.
And you've got flowers that are kind of yellowish green.
Not now, but I
you
really
did, yeah.
Into this little bayberry.
That makes me wonder whether they're infected with a type of pathogen called a phytoplasma. It's a bacterium-like organism, and the stunting, the discoloration of the foliage, and the kind of greenish-yellowish flowers are all relatively typical symptoms of that. If that's what you're dealing with, you dig up the plant, and you discard it, and you buy a new one, unfortunately.
Oh.
That particular type of organism, once it gets into the plant, it's there forever. And so you need to get rid of the plant.
And you can't plant in the same place?
You can plant in the same place.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
This particular group of organisms, they actually only colonize the food conducting tissue inside the plant called the phloem.
Oh.
And they're brought in by leafhoppers. And so the leafhopper feeds in the phloem and drops off the phytoplasma as it feeds. And the common diseases that are in this group are aster yellows, ash yellows, but we've been getting a lot of samples in the clinic this summer where we're getting another symptom is kind of what's called brooming, so tufts of leaves that are kind of distorted. And we've been doing a lot of testing for phytoplasmas and picking them up in a variety of different types of woody ornamentals. So I'm a little suspicious that that's what you're dealing with.
Where would it grow best?
This particular plant, get rid of, but Lisa, what's a good environment for
bayberries typically, and I've got to say I'm not as familiar with those as I am with some plants. That type of plant usually prefers a semi-acid soil that's somewhat moist and a protected area. They do like some sun, so at least 4 to 6 hours of sun would be recommended. It's just they're a little tough to grow in our area. I got to look here where you're coming from.
Racine.
You're in Racine. Okay. Well, you probably have it better than in Madison. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit warmer where you are. But is this an older plant, a new plant? Or
it's about 8 years old.
Oh, okay. All right, so this is the first year that you've seen that stunting and purpling and all of that.
Yeah, but aren't most of them burgundy colored?
Not necessarily, no.
No. Usually they're gonna be pretty dark green.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I'm wondering about a phytoplasma infection. Particularly with the flowers, that kind of weird color to the flowers makes me wonder.
What you might want to do is send Brian a sample next year.
Or if you can take some photos of the plant, if there's enough left on it right now, if you can take a digital photo and email it to me, you'd be welcome to do that.
And again, you'd send that to?
Huddleston, H-U-D-E-L-S-O-N, at wisc.edu. Also, for those of you, I gave out my website earlier. If you go to my website, there's an email address there. I have about 5 different emails, so it's a different one on the website than the one I just gave out, but it all goes into the same mailbox. So
okay.
So right. Take some photos and get them to me, and I can give you a little bit of a better sense of what might be going on.
Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Marty from Madison posted on Facebook that she wants a citrus tree like limey, like mine. And any recommendations on how do you overwinter it in the house? Okay, well,
you're the expert.
Well, I leave limey out all summer and spring, summer, and fall, and I bring limey in when it's getting. I should have probably brought limey in a little bit ago, but she seemed to be doing really well. And when I bring her in, I just water. Once a week, usually.
Yeah.
And
they don't like to be real wet.
No, they don't like trees. They don't like to be real wet.
And they like a lot of light, so you definitely need
a south facing. Yeah. I've got a south facing, and I also have a grow light that I put on limey. Although there are times when I forget the grow light, and then limey just sits there and seems to be doing just fine, and have limes. All the time. Once it comes in, it starts to bloom relatively soon, and I get lots of blossoms, and then I get limes that start out very small and like the size of an eraser on a pencil, and just keep growing until I take them off and eat them. In terms of where do you get them, I think good... there are some good, I'm not sure big box stores if I'd go there or not, but I would go to greenhouses. Many greenhouses have them for sale. You can even order them online.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They weren't available at the local greenhouse at the time, I got one online. I got limey online. Came to me in the mail. And there are many types. Bears makes, mine happens to be a Bears, BEARSS, lime tree. So there you go. They're not really a lot of work, to be perfectly honest.
As long as you have the light there.
As long as you have the light, and I happen to have south-facing windows in my bedroom, and so limey sits in the bedroom all winter and smells great. Mike in Polk County, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. We got about 3 inches of wet snow up here, so it's a little bit covered up already.
Oh, boy.
Our condolences.
Yes.
Anyway, I have grapes. I like a Concord. I think they call them a beta. But they've got a fungal disease that they dry up and turn black. But when would be the time to spray them and best time to prune them?
Well, grape pruning is typically done in March, and there are different pruning methods, and for different types of grapes, there are different protocols that you use. So what I would recommend is taking a look at our publication on the Learning Store that's called Growing Grapes in Wisconsin, and that tells you all the trellising information, the pruning information.
That is a really good publication.
It's a really nice publication.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there'll be some information in there also on the diseases. My guess, based on your description, is probably black rot. Mm-hmm. It's a fungal disease, causes kind of circular brown spots on the leaves, and then it'll get into the fruits and they kind of mummify. And there'll be some recommendations for fungicide control. The main thing is timing is very critical for controlling the diseases on the fruits, because if you don't get the timing right, you won't get control.
Mm-hmm. So they should, though, take off any mummified fruits.
Yeah, I would do good fall cleanup to remove all of that material, because that's where the fungus is going to survive. Interestingly, if you have things like Virginia creeper or Boston ivy anywhere near your grapes, that pathogen also goes to those particular hosts. So if you're really into growing grapes, you should keep those sorts of ornamentals away from your grapes.
I've got about 3 miles of Sleeping Charlie, I mean, Virginia creeper on my property. So
that may be where you're getting the inoculum, the fungal spores that are causing problems in your grapes.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Jim in Lake Poygan, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Well, good afternoon. Enjoy the show, of course, as usual. And I had the same problem. I'm calling about that lady that had the black spot where her stem goes into her tomato.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We had the same problems. We were heartbroken because our tomatoes were bigger around than the size of my thumb, the vines. The vines were just wonderful. So we started taking them and, fretting a little bit about it because it wasn't just one or two. They just started all coming in like that. So my wife did a little research, and she found out that if you got that problem because of all the wetness and stuff, pick the tomatoes when they're green or just when they start. It seems like just when they started turning red, they would start to get that. They wouldn't get that black spot until they started turning red or, continuing going turning red. So we pick them, and then it said put in your windowsill, stem side down. Put them in your window upside down or in a sunny area. It turned out perfect.
Oh.
So you ripened them inside, basically.
Yeah, right. And then all of a sudden, as the summer went on, all of a sudden we didn't have it anymore. So it must have been because of the weather got drier, apparently.
Yeah, we had kind of droughty conditions later on, kind of in August, so that would be less favorable for that those sorts of diseases to be a problem.
And we just finally picked our last tomatoes yesterday.
Good timing.
And, we're leaving all the vines and everything out, of course, because of the insects and everything going on there. And I have one more comment. Mm-hmm. How's the musky fishing, Larry?
The musky fishing has been almost non-existent for me this fall season, unfortunately. Jim, how about you?
Oh, I live on Lake Poygan.
I know. So you've been catching a few.
The northern's going good. The muskie's going. All the fishing is really, really good right now, matter of fact. And so is the duck hunting. Got to get ready for our Thanksgiving dinner,
Well, thank you, Vera. Thanks for the update. And sounds like Lake Poygan's a good place for fishermen right now. Thank you, Jim. Appreciate your call very much. Well, we've got Jen in Grafton. Jen, hi.
Hi. I'm calling about my caladiums. Is it okay to leave them in pots and bring them in and just let them dry out?
Yeah, you can do that. You cut off the dead foliage, and you gradually start to withhold water. Now, we don't recommend letting them completely dry out, so maybe once a month you can give it a light watering so it doesn't totally desiccate. I do have to say, though, that caladiums don't always come back as vigorously as before. I've had good luck in overwintering them, but then when they came back, they were kind of wimpy. So what you could do is, hit them with some fertilizer once they start to produce leaves again in the spring. Usually around March is when you're going to see them start to sprout again.
Yeah.
So, do let them get a good first set of leaves and then try fertilizing them and see if that helps any.
With a 10 or?
Yeah, 10 would be fine. Okay. I've usually, after a couple of not so good experiences, I said, okay, well, I'm just going to throw them out at the end of the year. But you hate to do that because, they're so beautiful.
Yeah, for sure. Jen, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And the music tells us it's time to end the show. Lisa and Brian, thank you both very much. Look forward to your next visit.
Thanks for having us.
Lisa Johnson is the Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, and Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW Madison. Great to have them with us, and they'll be back, and we're going to do a garden expo together next spring, too. I know we'll be talking more about that as well. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store.